Today on Against the Grain, the labor battles that took place in the fields of California, immortalized by John Steinbeck, took place on an epic scale involving tens of thousands of workers. Historian Catherine Olmsted argues that they were momentous for another reason, that the response from the business class led to the emergence of the new right. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Olmsted about modern conservatism's roots in the 1930s. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. What are the origins of modern conservatism? It's often argued that they're to be found in the failed presidential bid of Republican Barry Goldwater. Other scholars suggest, instead, the Cold War-era discontent of Midwestern small capitalists. Historian Catherine Olmsted argues, however, that it should be located even earlier in the intense and massive labor unrest that took place in the fields of California in the 1930s. In her book, Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism, which is published by the New Press, she posits that the response by growers and other members of the business class pioneered methods that have become familiar today as the hallmarks of the right. The use of populist language to defend elite interests, alliances formed between religious and business groups, the use of political consultants and publicists, the formation of industry groups, and the corporate funding of ostensibly grassroots organizations, and calling the left a threat to religion, the family, and race and gender hierarchies. Olmsted is chair of the history department at the University of California, Davis, and she joins me now. Can you begin by telling us to what degree the New Deal was a blow to big business and to what degree it wasn't?
Big business had some parts of the New Deal that it liked very much and others that it found very distressing, even revolutionary. On the one hand, a lot of business leaders in the United States liked the parts of the New Deal that encouraged big businesses to get together and create cartels to raise prices. Big businesses also often liked the infrastructure projects because the federal government was using tax money to improve roads, airports, in the case of California, build dams and canals that were very useful for businessmen because it was effectively a way that the government was helping the big businessmen to expand their markets. But what the business leaders in the United States, for the most part, really despised about the New Deal was its labor laws. The labor laws that protected workers' right to join unions. Now, the New Deal administration created these labor laws because they wanted to avoid socialism. They didn't want to have too great a government role in the economy. So they said, well, if we don't actively redistribute income, how can we encourage workers to get together so that they can collectively raise their wages within the capitalist system? Well, the solution would be making it easier for them to form unions. And so the labor laws were part of Roosevelt's recovery strategy, but at the same time, they threatened big businessmen because, of course, they threatened businesses' control over wages and profits.
Now, those labor laws didn't apply to every sector of workers. There was two significant sectors left out, domestic workers and agricultural workers. How did that come to pass that those laws around collective bargaining didn't apply to them?
Well, in the 1930s, the South, the former Confederacy, was part of the Democratic Party, was part of the Democratic Party coalition. It was basically a one-party region. And so Roosevelt, in order to get any of his New Deal laws passed, needed to have Southern votes. And the Southern Democratic lawmakers were determined not to allow their sharecroppers and maids to form unions. And so they made it clear to Roosevelt and to the Northern Democrats that if they wanted their votes for these labor laws, they would have to leave out domestic workers and agricultural workers. And this meant that African Americans were disproportionately pushed to the margins of the New Deal.
So the story that you tell in your book, Right Out of California, obviously takes place in the West. And I wonder if you could talk about what big business looked like in the West, what were sort of its contours, and the degree to which the policies of the New Deal would be particularly abrasive, let's say, for the business elite in California and in the West.
Well, the biggest industry in California at that time was agribusiness. And agribusiness was disproportionately corporate-owned. In California and throughout the West, there tended to be much bigger farms, much more large-scale, more specialized, more highly capitalized. The land was more expensive. And this was a legacy that dated back to the Spanish period when they had the big haciendas and land grants, but also had to do with the fact that in California in particular, they needed irrigation in order to farm. And if you need irrigation, then you need dams and canals. It takes a lot of capital. So the writer Carrie McWilliams described California agriculture as factories in the field. It didn't mean that there were no small farmers, but it just agriculture in California was disproportionately centralized, and the farms were owned for the most part by large landowners. And in California, this meant that railroads and insurance companies and oil companies and banks owned these large corporate farms, especially in the Central Valley. And they were particularly dependent on government irrigation projects. And so up until the New Deal, corporate agriculture in California had been very statist, had been in favor of a big government because the government built the dams and the canals that made it possible for them to farm in this arid state. It's only when they decided that the New Deal meant that their workers would try to organize unions and raise their pay that corporate agribusiness began to turn against the New Deal.
But if agricultural workers were exempted from these New Deal laws, then why were they concerned?
Well, that's the really interesting part, is that the agricultural workers were excluded from the New Deal laws. They did not get the protections that industrial workers did. However, the agricultural workers didn't know this. They were oblivious to the fact that they had been excluded from these laws. What they heard was that President Roosevelt wants you to form a union. They heard about all these industrial workers throughout the United States demanding the right to form a union and going out on strike when their employers refused to let them. And so the agricultural workers in California heard of this, and they were among the most desperately poor people in America at that time. They whole families would work in the fields. They would earn barely enough money to feed themselves. And so when they heard that there were these labor laws that were protecting unions, they decided to start forming the unions. And the sad part was, of course, that they were not protected. And so when they went out on strike, they did not get the same sort of, labor board intervention that industrial workers did.
So you're describing these agriculture workers who then tried to organize themselves. Who were they? We get a picture of some of them from John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, but to what degree is that a reliable indicator, and Steinbeck himself, in fact, of who these agricultural workers were and how they were organizing themselves?
Well, it depends on what year you're talking about. In the early 1930s and during the big farm worker strikes of 1933, the farm workers in California were overwhelmingly Mexican and Filipino immigrants. There were perhaps 25% at most of the workers in the field were native-born white Americans in 1933. Now, by 1939, when Steinbeck published The Grapes of Wrath, the workforce, the farm labor force in California had become a lot more Anglo because of the Dust Bowl and the Southwestern migration, the Okies and the Arkies that he wrote about. And what's interesting about Steinbeck's portrayal is that his first big farm labor book was In Dubious Battle, which was published in 1936. And he did a lot of research for it. He interviewed the leaders of the big cotton strike of 1933 that involved almost 20,000 workers walking off the fields. And he knew a lot about it. He had reported on it. Yet when he wrote his novel, he decided to make it all about white men. Even though the cotton strike that he was basing his novel on had been both women and men participating, one of the leaders of it was a woman, most of the workers were Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants, yet the novel portrays it entirely as a struggle among different groups of white men.
To what degree is Steinbeck a reliable source in terms of his characterization of the politics involved in these strikes?
Well, that's another thing that Steinbeck did, is when he wrote about these strikes, he decided to make the workers quite noble and the growers to be villainous. But he also decided that the union leaders, the union organizers who were from the Communist Party, he made them to be these dogmatic leftists who really didn't care at all about the workers, but instead were just using the strikes in order to get more conflict. They sought out violence so that they could radicalize the workers and bring about the revolution. But everyone who was observing it at the time, the strikes, did not believe this to be the case. The communists who were leading the strikes were actually very idealistic young men and women who had a very vague notion of even what Marxism was. They were not trying to exacerbate the conflicts to bring the revolution, but they were just concerned about helping the workers to organize so that they could get more power and money.
My guest today is Catherine Olmsted. She is the author of Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism, as published by the New Press. She's the chair of the history department at UC Davis. So you just mentioned the communists who were involved in these agricultural strikes. And I want to ask you more about the strikes, but perhaps you could describe for us the left in California in the 1930s. Obviously, not all of the left was involved in these battles, but just to give us a sense of what were the forces that were arrayed against each other at the time.
Well, California was a land of political extremes in the 1930s. On the right, there was a small fascist movement and a Ku Klux Klan in the Central Valley. There was also a strong Republican Party that was split between an extremely conservative wing and a more progressive wing. On the left, there was a relatively small Democratic Party in the early 30s that gained strength as the New Deal continued. But on the far left, there was also a vibrant socialist movement in California and a communist party, the second largest communist party outside of New York. And it was the communist party that was involved in organizing the farm workers in the 1930s, the early 1930s, largely because the more conventional, traditional capitalist unions like the American Federation of Labor were not interested in organizing farm workers at that time. It was very difficult and dangerous business, and the farm workers were split along ethnic lines. They were often immigrants from different countries. They didn't speak the same language. And the most difficult part was that even if you were able finally to get a group of farm workers to organize a union, then once the harvest was over, these union members would all move on and go to different harvests, and you'd have to start all over again with the next crop. So for that reason, there was not much AFL organizing in the California fields, and instead it was left, therefore, for the Communist Party to step in and try to organize the workers into a union that could carry off a strike and actually succeed in raising wages.
And how did they contend with those obstacles that you talked about, the ethnic differences between farm workers in the fields, the circulation of workers? How did the radical organizers deal with those challenges?
Well, it was really difficult for them. One thing that they did was to try to help the workers overcome or transcend their racial prejudices by encouraging the different ethnic and racial groups to mingle at dinner. During the big strikes, they would have strike camps because the growers would evict the workers from their property. And so then the workers, the strikers, would all gather in one big camp on the land owned by, say, a sympathetic small grower. And in the cotton strike of 1933, there was an enormous camp outside of Corcoran near Bakersfield, where 5,000 strikers lived. And there were Okies and Arkies and African Americans and Filipinos, but mainly Mexicans and Mexican Americans. And what the communist organizers did was to pick what they called a lieutenant to represent each of these different groups. And then each of the lieutenants would eat with the main organizers at a central table in the strike camp at dinner time. And then they would encourage the rank and file workers to try to eat together, eat among a different ethnic group every night, as a way of teaching the workers, you know, you don't have to fear these other groups. These are your comrades, and these are people that if we can all get together, we can all help each other.
Well, tell us about the strike that you've just mentioned, the 1933 strike in the San Joaquin Valley, which still is the largest agricultural strike in U.S. history.
Well, it was a truly massive undertaking. The cotton-growing areas in the Central Valley are 100 miles long and 40 miles wide. And these organizers from the Communist Party Union helped to channel the workers' discontent. The workers were already interested in going out on strike, and the Communist Party organizers arrived and helped them organize this strike. It was about 18 to 20,000 workers who refused to pick the cotton at the height of the harvest. And cotton does go bad, just like fruits and vegetables do if it's not picked in time. So it was a desperate moment for the growers. Yet the growers were taking a very hard line and refusing to raise the wages of the pickers. And so the workers went out on strike. They stayed out on strike for about 2 weeks. And the growers tried to bring in strike breakers to pick the cotton. And the strikers would travel around in caravans, park on the streets in front of the great cotton fields, and then yell at the workers who were picking and try and encourage them to join the strike. And it got more and more tense, with the growers using local law enforcement to arrest the strikers for vagrancy, which was sort of an all-purpose charge back in those days. And the California Highway Patrol was clearing the highways, not allowing picketing. And then finally, the growers got a big meeting together, essentially a vigilante meeting outside of Bakersfield one night. And the crowd got into a frenzy. And the next morning, a group of vigilantes attacked two separate groups of strikers and killed three of them.
Now, obviously, this strike was incredibly large in terms of scope, but were there other significant agricultural strikes that took place in the same period?
Well, there was at the same time in the Southeast, particularly in Arkansas, there were organizers from the Socialist Party that were trying to help sharecroppers to form a union called the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. And it similarly faced a lot of opposition from the plantation owners and a lot of violence directed against it, a lot of vigilante action.
And who were these vigilantes?
Well, that's a part that's a part of the story that's a little difficult to nail down. For the most part, in California, the vigilantes were growers, some of them individuals who owned quite large farms. Some of them were the business people in the towns who were quite angry at the people they viewed as aliens and agitators. That was the phrase they used over and over again, the agitators being the communists and the aliens being the Latinos. There was a division among small growers, a surprising number of small growers were supportive of the workers. Perhaps because they had a personal connection to the workers. They had small farms, they would hire a handful of people, and they were much more sympathetic to the workers' demands. So it tended to be more the townspeople who didn't interact with the farm workers and the large growers who joined these vigilante groups.
Well, let's talk a bit more about these large growers who are central to the history that you tell about the response to all this class struggle in the fields of California. Who were they, these large growers, and what kind of power did they have?
Well, there were a lot of corporations that were the large growers, and so they were absentee, and they would hire foremen, supervisors who would manage the farms for them. That was a large number. So when I say large grower, I don't actually mean the person who owned the land, but the person who was managing the land for a corporation. There were also some individuals who had very vast holdings. There was J.G. Boswell in the Central Valley, who was known as the Cotton King of Kings County. There was the DiGiorgio farms that had the largest fruit packing house in the world. There were growers around Fresno who would have thousands of acres in peaches, say, who had just over the years been able to buy up many of their neighbors until they had amassed a huge amount of land and wealth.
And so you've talked about harnessing vigilantes and in response to this labor unrest. So to what degree were these strikers successful? And what other kinds of responses did these growers then turn to?
Well, at first, at the very beginning, the workers were able to get some intervention from the administration in Washington, even though the New Deal did not protect their right to join a union. There were New Deal administrators in California who were appalled at the vigilante violence against the strikers. And so in the cotton strike of 1933, after the three strikers were killed, The head of the New Deal Recovery Administration in California, George Creel, went to Visalia to broker a settlement to the strike. And he got the state government involved, and the state government appointed a commission. And eventually they hammered out a compromise where the workers won a victory. They didn't get nearly as much money as they wanted, and they didn't get their union recognized. But they did get more money for their labor for that particular harvest of that particular cotton crop. And this was really the high point of government intervention in these agricultural labor strikes. And it was also the beginning of the growers' determination to make sure nothing like that ever happened again. And so the growers, after the cotton strike, formed an organization called the Associated Farmers that later became very notorious. They called it the Associated Farmers, but it was mostly packers and shippers and corporate growers that funded this organization that, on the one hand, went off after the communist organizers and tried to get local governments to indict them for violating the state's Criminal Syndicalism Act. And then, on the other hand, started to whip up public opposition to farm worker unions in general and also to the New Deal.
That's the voice of historian Catherine Olmsted. We'll return with her in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with historian Catherine Olmsted about the history of the modern conservative movement. She has written a book right out of California about the roots of the right-wing backlash that would take place later in the 20th century in the agricultural struggles in the California fields. Right Out of California is published by the New Press. She's chair of the history department at the University of California, Davis, and her other books include Challenging the Secret Government and Real Enemies. So as I've just mentioned, you argue in Right Out of California that a lot of the characteristics that we associate with the American right in the late 20th century actually can be traced back to exactly this time, to these struggles, this agricultural unrest in the 1930s in the context of the New Deal. And as we'll talk about further in the program, there are a lot of different arguments that locate the origins of modern conservatism at different times in different places. You are locating it much earlier. And I wonder if you could talk about the features of the grower response that in many ways foreshadows the kinds of mechanisms and approaches that are characteristic of the contemporary American right?
Well, I see 1933 as the big breaking point, the big turning point in the conservative movement in America. Because before 1933, conservatives, business leaders were not anti-government. They liked many of the ways that the government intervened in the economy, because the government intervened in the economy to benefit big business. So it levied tariffs to protect their markets. It built the infrastructure that enabled them to expand their markets. And it helped them to control labor by sometimes sending in troops, or at least turning a blind eye against when employers used violence against workers. And also helped them to control labor through prohibition of alcohol. So there were many ways that a heavy hand of the government in the economy was beneficial to big business. And in the early New Deal, big businesses saw that the government was still doing many of these things to help them, like the dams and the canals in California, the infrastructure projects and agricultural subsidies. But what really changes in 1933 is that the government decides under Franklin Roosevelt, well, we're going to create a level playing field between business and labor. We're not going to allow business to get away with many of the anti-union activities that they'd been engaged in up to this point. With the Wagner Act in 1935, the government started to make sure that employers bargained in good faith with unions. And so it made it much easier for workers to join unions, and millions more did. This was anathema to a lot of corporations, to corporate leaders in the United States, is that suddenly they saw the government as not their friend and helper, but as the enemy. And even though the government continued many of its previous strategies for helping business, policies for helping business, in 1933, it began to stop business from using these unfair trade practices and these and this directing all of this violence against workers. And so it was at that point that a lot of corporate leaders began to develop what we would call an anti-status philosophy that we associate with a modern Republican Party.
Well, what sort of innovations did those big business leaders come up with that we might recognize in some form today as being hallmarks of the American right?
Well, one problem that they had right away was that they realized that there were not a lot of people who sympathized with their economic arguments. That Franklin Roosevelt, for example, won an overwhelming re-election in 1936, the biggest re-election victory since James Monroe ran unopposed in 1820. And so this meant that there were a lot of working class and middle class Americans who felt that Roosevelt's policies, particularly his labor policies, were helping them. So how could conservatives get a majority of voters onto their side? Well, what they decided to do was to emphasize cultural arguments and to portray the Democratic Party, Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, social democracy in general, as a cultural rather than an economic threat. And in particular, they began to associate the left with a threat to religion, a threat to the family, a threat to gender and racial hierarchy.
And what was going on at that time in the United States around race and gender, but let's start with race, that would create a situation where various people who might be better served with different economic policies would be swayed by these cultural arguments?
Well, it depends on where you were in the United States, what kind of racial argument would appeal to you. In California, arguments about race were usually about Latinos and were framed in terms of there are these aliens coming into the United States. I mean, it would be very familiar to many of us listening to the rhetoric in the Republican presidential race today. The argument was there are these aliens, they're not like us, they have different values, they have a different religion, they have different political values, and they're not like us. And somehow the New Deal policies are encouraging these aliens and empowering them in ways that are threatening to the rest of us. Now, that was in California. In other parts of the country, of course, the arguments could be made about African Americans or about other groups of immigrants.
And then what about gender? What sort of anxieties did the right play on around gender roles and shifts to gender roles?
Well, this is still early, but it's interesting that you can see at this time a lot of anxiety about women supposedly leaving their proper place in the home. With the Depression, there were a lot of women who were forced to work in order to, you know, help their families survive. in the California fields. The Communist Party was organizing the workers, and it used a lot of women as leaders. This was partly ideological because the Communist Party, at least in theory, though not always in practice, was committed to gender equality, and also was just pragmatic, that they realized that there was a lot of violence directed against communists. They were threatened with lynching and mob violence all the time. And if the party used women, there was still enough chivalry, traditional gender values among even the vigilantes that they were much less likely to attack women union organizers than they were men union organizers. So there was just this general anxiety that the economic collapse was threatening the traditional gender roles, and also the very real example of the Communist Party putting women front and center in their organizing activities, that made Americans who supported sort of the traditional family very anxious and uncertain and a little angry, and thus receptive to appeals by the conservatives that Roosevelt was bringing too much change and threatening the family.
Was there also a sense that the New Deal had brought all sorts of innovations, or at least in certain parts of the country, maybe particularly around certain major cities, of a kind of a cultural flourishing on the left, all sorts of experimentation in terms of art, but also in the service of a particular leftward-leaning politics? Was there a reaction in some way to that kind of generally left-wing cultural flourishing that the right played on?
Well, there was certainly, yes, right-wing opposition to what they saw as a movement in art that celebrated the people, that celebrated the average person, and therefore seemed suspiciously communist. You can see this particularly in Carmel, where there was an artistic bohemian community that was quite leftist, and some of whose members were beginning to organize, help the workers organize in the fields. And there was a faction in Carmel and the surrounding area of conservative business people who were very angry about this confluence of radical culture and politics.
Catherine Olmsted is my guest. She teaches history at UC Davis and is the author of Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism, which we're discussing today. That's published by the New Press, and you can find a link to the book on our website, againstthegrain.org. One of the things that is striking in your book is that this right-wing backlash that you're talking about in the mid-30s, one of the ways that it took shape was to use various different organizational forms that we might recognize today as key organizational forms of the right. And that includes things like the formation of industry groups, the use of political consultants and publicists. Can you tell us about some of those innovations and what they looked like at that time?
Well, a real moment of terror for conservatives in California was in 1934, the fall of 1934, when the Democratic primary voters of California nominated as their candidate for governor Upton Sinclair, the socialist author. And he had run for governor of California over and over again as a socialist and never gotten anywhere. In 1933, he re-registered as a Democrat. And in 1934, he ran for governor of California. And he had, as opposed to Roosevelt, you know, genuinely radical goals and policies. He wanted to have a very steep, progressive income tax and property tax. He wanted to exempt most people from the property tax and have a very high property tax on wealthy corporations and individuals. And then he would use this money, he said, to have sort of a socialism in one state, where the state would take over unused factories and farms and turn them into co-ops. So it really was a real socialist program, and it was going to result, if he was elected and succeeded in getting his policies through, in an actual redistribution of wealth in the state. So the people in the state who had the most wealth and power were terrified, and they spent an unprecedented amount of money. We don't know exactly how much because it wasn't reported, but people rumored that it was up to $10 million, which was just unheard of in those days. And they used it with advertisements, of course, but also faked newsreels and hiring political consultants for the very first time. There were two political consultants in Sacramento named Clem Whitaker and Leon Baxter, who had just gone into business the year before and were the first political consultants in the nation. And what that meant was they weren't just speechwriters, they weren't just advertising consultants. They were for hire to run campaigns. The candidates or the interests, the industry groups could hire them, and they would completely from scratch create a campaign and write the speeches, write the advertisements, plan the schedule, come up with the platform, the policies, all themselves, and they did it based on what they thought would win. And one of the things that they discovered really worked against Sinclair was to use this cultural threat argument, because they discovered that his economic ideas, as radical as they were, really were quite popular. And so what they had to do was to sort of separate a lot of people who supported his financial ideas from his coalition by really emphasizing his supposed threat to the family and the church.
To what degree did these consultants and publicists and their friends in the media disseminating these ideas, to what degree did they cast all of this in the language of populism? Obviously not a new thing in American history.
They cast these arguments in the language of populism. But instead of talking about a moneyed elite that the people had to fight against, they talked about a cultural elite, that Upton Sinclair and Franklin Roosevelt were part of this group of alien intellectuals, eggheads who didn't understand the people. And in particular, they cast these elites as pretentious and as secular, as anti-religious, and therefore a threat to traditional religious values and to the traditional family. And in particular, what Whitaker and Baxter discovered is that they could mobilize a lot of conservative women who otherwise had been apolitical, and mobilize them and encourage them to go knock on doors and make speeches, because they said Upton Sinclair, the Democratic Party, Franklin Roosevelt, threaten your home. He's a socialist. He has these radical ideas. And let's not talk about the economics of it, but let's talk about how he threatens, how his radical ideas are actually going to encourage women to work outside the home, encourage Californians to be less religious and therefore lose their moral values. And the interesting thing about this is that, you know, they sort of lumped Sinclair with the Democratic Party as a whole, even though Franklin Roosevelt didn't endorse Sinclair. And at the end of the day, it completely cut him off. And the Democratic Party of California did a secret deal with the Republican nominee because they were terrified of Sinclair as well.
Well, the kind of cultural argument that you've just articulated of opposition to a cultural elite that is out of touch with the common person, the anti-intellectual, anti-egghead angle to it, as well as a sense of upending traditional values, it's hard not to think of someone like Ronald Reagan in hearing your description. To what degree can we see a connection then, leaping quite far into the future, between two other key figures of the right who came out of California, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan?
Well, I think there's a direct connection. An important figure in my book is Herbert Hoover, who was the first president from California. He was born in Iowa, but came to California to go to Stanford and continued to have a residence here throughout the 1930s. And Herbert Hoover helped to organize this national conservative backlash to the New Deal. And Herbert Hoover helped to discover Richard Nixon in 1946 and encourage and fund Nixon to run for Congress for the first time right after World War II. And Hoover helped organize donors for Nixon and also connected him with the political consultants who would help frame Nixon's message, which was very similar to the message that the conservatives used in California in 1934 against Upton Sinclair. So you can see this direct line from Hoover to Nixon. Nixon, in turn, developed this group of donors and consultants and advisors who would go on to advise Reagan in the 1960s, or to train the people who would advise Reagan in the 1960s, so that Reagan was elected governor of California in 1966. And he had a lot of the same backers as who had backed Nixon in the 40s and 50s. It is who had been organized by Hoover back in the 1930s. So that you have these three California presidents, Hoover, Nixon, and Reagan, developing and refining these California political techniques and then taking them to the national stage.
I want to end by asking you about why this history matters. In locating the origins of modern conservatism, one often reads that it was driven by small business owners in the Midwest. There's arguments about the South. There are arguments about the West as well, but they tend to take place later. People in the Sun Belt, in the suburbs, driving a right-wing backlash. But what you're arguing, Catherine Olmsted, in Right Out of California, is that the pivotal moment that would launch the modern conservative movement can be located in California in the 1930s in the agricultural fields. Beyond just getting history right, what do you think is at stake in locating it there rather than later on?
Well, I would argue that it helps us to understand what's really motivating the conservative movement. And it's not that those other arguments are wrong about the new right being located in the suburbs and being about sex education and cultural issues. But I think those arguments are incomplete. We have to put labor and government labor policies at the center of our understanding of the modern conservative movement, because it was the government's decision to start protecting workers' right to form unions that drove a lot of these corporate leaders, business leaders, national conservative leaders to decide, okay, this is it now. This is the moment when the government becomes our enemy. This is the moment when we have to mobilize a national movement and figure out strategies to get a majority of voters to join our coalition, because this is the real threat to our wealth and power.
Well, would you say then that, one of the arguments about the origins of modern conservatism is that a lot of the business class had resigned itself to the New Deal, and that there were, as you have also enumerated, various ways that the New Deal actually helped big business. And so some of the traditional sectors of big business on the East Coast were not going to oppose the New Deal. And it really took people on the margins, the people who formed the John Birch Society and so on, to labor in the wilderness for many years before they could get the rest of actual big business on board in opposing these policies. Why then would it be the case, or why then was it the case, that big business in California, particularly agricultural big business, found this to be such an existential threat when big business elsewhere took much longer to get on board rolling back the New Deal?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that it's in part because agribusiness in California had been so dependent on the government that it felt doubly betrayed in 1933 when it felt that the government was now turning against it and coming in and intervening in these agricultural labor strikes. I think that agribusiness in California had long depended on a very tractable labor force, that it could pay very little money in order to make the kind of profits that it did. And so it was particularly threatening to agribusiness to learn that it might not have as much control over its labor force in the future. And as I say, this is really a disproportionate reaction because, in fact, you know, the agricultural workers were left out of the New Deal protections. But nevertheless, because agribusiness was so dependent on paying its workers so little and being able to control them so completely, it was especially terrified at the prospect, even if it wasn't a reality, but the prospect that government policy would somehow alter the balance of power in their workplaces, which were the fields of California.
Catherine Olmsted has been my guest. We've been talking about her book, Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. That's published by the New Press. Her other books include Real Enemies and Challenging the Secret Government. She teaches history at UC Davis, where she is chair of the history department. Catherine, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast.